KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
In clouds and rain tomorrow, highs in the upper 40s.
I believe my mission in life is really to leave a better state, a better country than what I was born into. And I thought I was pretty fortunate.
To write about Jefferson, Adams, Hamilton, Washington in that period and not refer to this constant fear of Britain is like writing about Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson and not mentioning the Soviet Union. You know, it was that kind of an enveloping drama. There we have the perils and possibilities of politics. One man's an imperial tyrant is another man's shrewd savior.
John Meacham talking about Thomas Jefferson, his new book, The Art of Power. We're taking up the art of power as well with Governor Chris Gregoire as she is ending her tenure as the 22nd governor of the state of Washington. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Though you have one more month, so there is work to be done yet, yes?
Yes, there is. I'm not letting up one bit.
What are your first, what aren't you letting up on in this next 30 plus days?
Well, what I'm trying to do is make sure that this is the best transition humanly possible to the new governor. I've got a budget to do, and it's going to be a challenge, and so I'm working feverishly on that. And I'm trying to finish off some big, big issues so that when the governor comes in, he can pay attention to those things that are his priority and feel confident that these other issues, like Hanford cleanup, for example, are back on track and in moving forward so he can focus more on his priorities. So a lot of work to be done.
What else are you looking at besides the Hanford cleanup, which I'm going to come back to when you said those big issues?
Chehalis, remember several years ago when we had the devastating flood? It was a 100-year flood.
Yes.
Well, we have got to ensure that we take action so that doesn't happen again. And the folks down there have come together. I asked them earlier this year, you know, I'm very familiar with what happened, how it happened. I have a passion for it because I saw the people up close and personal. Let's get going. Let's reach consensus. They're in the process of doing so, so I want to move that issue forward. So it's those kinds of things that I want to make sure we get done.
They had a little trouble meeting consensus in the early days after the flood.
They have.
Land development issues in part.
Yeah. You know, a lot of that is a floodplain area, and so it's a challenge to economically develop and yet make sure that you're prepared for the next flood, which is inevitable to happen. And I-5 can't afford to be buried under 8 feet of water and shut off the West Coast. So we've got a challenge there, and I want to be able to make sure that that's passed the baton off to Jay, and he's ready to take it.
Are we talking about state money and doing more work to either drain or elevate parts of I-5 down there?
Or you
not
know,
drain I-5, but the drain areas around I-5.
Well, and we're going to have to look at, do we have storage? If so, what kind of storage? What are the impact to the fisheries resource? Can we, in fact, enhance while at the same time protecting for flood purposes and allowing the economy to grow down there? So it's not an easy issue. It's fairly complicated, but they're in the process now of reaching consensus. That consensus is not necessarily we're going to do everything and this is the answer, but several things that can and should be done, several things that still need additional study before a final decision is made.
Aren't you going to miss all this, Governor? Big ideas, big picture stuff?
You know, there are definite aspects of it that I will miss. It's been a wonderful go. It's been a tremendously challenging and humbling experience. I have to say at the end of the day, despite the recession, no regrets. I really have enjoyed the opportunity to serve the people of the state. But it's time for a new chapter in the state, and I'm going to pass that baton and look forward to new leadership.
No regrets? Not even a little arm twisting done here or there over the last 8 years?
I have regrets of things that I would like to have happened differently. Make no mistake about that. But no regrets at having run. No regrets at having stepped up to the challenge, and I think my family supports me and feels the same way.
All right, just an interlude here. You're enjoying having, what'd you say, how old is your grandchild?
A little over 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the middle of all this,
mm-hmm.
Huh?
It's fantastic. I highly recommend grandparenthood to anybody and everybody. You know, You find in your life that you fall in love just a very few times. You know, you fall in love with your spouse, let's say. You fall in love with your children, and then you kind of think it's over. And then one day into your arms comes this little miracle, and you fall in love again. It's just an amazing, I love it. I can't tell you how exciting it is for my husband and I to have a new grandchild.
So you'll be just doting grandparents for the next few months?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
After you're done with the job, I mean.
Yes.
Nobody's called yet. You haven't had to make any commitments to fly to D.C. at this point.
I'm not clear on what I want to do next. So I'm not doing anything other than paying attention to my job.
All right. I want to start in the present. I want to jump back if I can, because you said you have to work out a budget.
Yeah.
And pass a budget to the legislature. But that's not a budget that'll necessarily be taken up by the next. They may change the budget, the next legislative session and the next governor.
Absolutely.
So you have also said in this gubernatorial campaign that the math doesn't allow for increasing the funding in education without some kind of new revenue.
Correct.
So will this budget that you present include some new revenue sources?
It has to. As we're going into the 13-15 biennium, while the internals look good, our economy is recovering. Things are going well. Now, if Congress messes up again, that could be different. But assuming that they get their act together and are able to take appropriate action, we're on the road to recovery. Having said that, however, it's not the recovery that we've typically seen in the past. It's going to be slow. It's not going to happen overnight, and the results of which is we're still down $900 million going into the 13-15 biennium and expected to be down $1 billion going into the 15-17. So if we can correct ourselves for this next biennium, that should take care of the following one. But meanwhile, we've cut over $11 billion in the last 3 years, so to find more cuts is really a challenge. And that's all to be done before we look at the new bill that we have in the mail from our state Supreme Court, which is about $1 billion in 13-15 alone, and that's K-12 education. That will grow to about 1.6 per year by the time we hit 2018.
1.6 per year increase. What we spend now.
Correct. $1.6 billion.
Well, all right. You want to share a little idea of where you would find new revenue?
Well, I'm still working on it. We've got every idea you can imagine, and then some, on the table right now, looking at what we should do. I've been talking with the governor-elect because I know how strongly he feels, and I want to honor as best I can where he is, because I don't want this to be a budget that goes to the legislature and is thrown out, and no one is looking at it that way. The new governor won't have a chance, probably, to do a new budget much before the February forecast. And that's at the same time the legislature will be working on its own. So the only tool for the legislature to look to will be my budget proposal. So I'm putting as much heart and soul into this one as I have any of the previous ones to make sure I've given them the best I can and the governor-elect the best I can.
You know, you said that just to start where you started, assuming Congress gets its act together. We know what it is to assume. So is there a plan B? I mean, is there a fallback in case that protects the state in case Congress doesn't get its act together?
Well, if they don't solve the challenge at hand, I expect they'll kick the can down the road. Now, that's not necessarily good news for us because we're a sales tax state, which is so dependent on consumer confidence. That could be a negative for consumer confidence for us. But kicking the can down the road, not that I favor it, but it would be a far better avenue than letting sequestration take place. That, in my mind, pushes us into a double-dip recession. Back we go into a recession, and we'll have a really challenging time pulling out. So I don't think Congress – I know Congress never intended the sequestration to ever take place, so I don't expect them to do nothing. The least they can do is kick the can, but they really, really need to step up to it, accept the challenge, compromise. That is what that institution is about, the art of compromise, and move the country's economy forward.
But won't anything they do have to involve kicking the can down the road? Because they're not going to really engage in Social Security reforms, Medicaid cuts, defense cuts. So they're going to have to just find some way to make the cliff.
You know, the truth be known, we were on a conference call with the vice president last week, and it's not as if, and you know, Senator Murray led the way, and so they have scoured everything. Everything is on the table. It's not as if they need to study or think anew. Everything is sitting on the table. It's ready for the compromise. So now they believed, if you'll recall, last time they did have a compromise, and the speaker couldn't deliver his caucus. That led to the disaster, and that led to the sequestration. So now it's time for them to look at everything that's on the table and match it up and come to the kind of compromise that will allow us to continue our entitlement programs so that people are feeling secure and good about the future of those entitlement programs, whether it's Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid, at the same time moving the country forward economically.
But didn't some of the compromise entail some cuts in the entitlements that a lot of activists on that side thought were much too onerous?
Not really. What is preserved is Medicare and Medicaid. They are exempt from those cuts if sequestration was to go into place. The devastating piece of sequestration, of course, which is a motivator, is what it would do to defense. And if it were to happen in this state alone, it could result in over 40,000 job loss, because we're such a defense-oriented state, military-oriented state.
I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But I mean, when they tried to come up with a compromise in the first place, there were people on the Democratic side who say this compromise that President Obama is supporting, which in the end did not occur, was too hard on the Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid.
Yes. There's no question it's got to be one delicate balance, because you're going to have folks on the Democratic side who are going to be there for the entitlement programs. You're going to have folks on the Republican side who are going to say, you know, no new taxes or no increase in taxes whatsoever, even for the wealthy, which I totally disagree with. But the bottom line is it's got to be a well-crafted compromise. But everybody seems to be in the right frame of mind following the election, knowing full well what the president said literally everywhere he went during the course of the campaign. I think the Republicans have now heard. America has said, yes, the wealthy must step up and help us in this time of need. And no, it's not going to make our economy slow down. To the contrary, it will allow us, because the middle class will get what they need and deserve, will have greater buying power, which is the engine for our economy in this country.
So, look, I said we were going to do a reflection, and I'm asking on current issues, but it reflects. Can we really afford to see the Defense Department as a jobs program? Because every legislative district is going to say, look, I can't afford to see defense cuts because those are jobs in my district, or as you said, jobs in our state, when we spend so much more on defense than the rest of the world, and it is – unless it's a jobs program, in which case I'd love to hear that argument from the Republicans too. It's government spending all this money in a way that may not be sustainable over the long term, and that defense is where maybe we should be looking.
We should look at defense. We should make cuts there. I'm now the co-chair of what's called the Council of Governors, where we're looking at cuts to our National Guard. So I'm engaged. I'm involved in all of that effort with regard to cuts, and I've made it clear on behalf of all the nation's governors, we know how to cut probably better than anybody in Congress. We've had to. We didn't have a choice. So we're ready to make cuts, but we're not going to, for example, make the cuts on the back of the National Guard for the United States Air Force. It has to be fair. It has to be right for the military strategy of tomorrow, which the president has outlined. That strategy is really about the Pacific Rim. That means we're well positioned. So we're ready. I think everybody understands there has to be cuts in defense, but not the devastating cuts that sequestration would result in.
Because they're across the board?
They're across the board.
Or are they too high?
And they're too high. Both. They will take us back to levels well in our history. That is not good for America. We have to be ready to defend America and America's principles. So we need to take cuts in defense, no question about it. Winding down our presence in Afghanistan is part of that. But there are more cuts to be had. There are more efficiencies to be had in the United States military. We need to step up to that. But at the same time, sequestration is like a axe to our Defense Department, which never was intended by Congress. It's to motivate them to get something done.
All right. I just have one question that you said. What is our role in the Pacific Rim with an increased military presence? I mean, what are we talking about, and I'm putting this in quotes, standing up to China? I mean, what's our role facing the West, America, I mean?
So what the president has said is that it's important for us to have a overall strategy, and that strategy is clearly having readiness for the Pacific Rim. That readiness is making sure we're militarily positioned well, and that's in the West. And so that's why Washington State is critical, whether it's JBLM or whether it's Air Force, whether it's subs, whether it's Navy, you name it. We are well positioned to be a part of the president's strategy moving forward, which has been absolutely embraced by the Secretary of Defense and the department.
Say, if the president did call, would you be interested in national security issues?
You know, I have no question in my mind that Secretary Napolitano is doing a fantastic job. And having spoken to her recently,
state could be open.
Her to stay. No, no. I think best left to those who the president thinks are names on the table that we're hearing about today.
Okay, Gary Locke might be getting tired of China. You never know.
Mm-hmm.
He's been there a long time,
and he's doing a great job.
All right. Chris Gregoire is our guest. She is the governor of Washington State, the second woman to hold this office. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll do a little reflection on the past 8 years. This is Weekday.
Good morning. It's 9:21. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. We have partly sunny skies and 42 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 49. Forecast says it's going to be mostly sunny a little bit later today. Tonight, partly cloudy, the low in the upper 30s. We're expecting clouds and showers tomorrow, the high in the upper 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Medical Centers, offering preventive care and workplace health risk assessments to support healthy lives. Same day, evening, Saturday, Sunday, and online doctor appointments available through MyChart at pacmed.org.
Coming up, we'll explore the life of Thomas Jefferson, as told by Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Meacham. His latest book is called Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. He joins us in about 10 minutes.
Governor Gregoire is ending her tenure as the 22nd governor after having to come up with a budget yet and some other things. She's here to just talk about some of the issues. I wanted to ask you about something. 2006, you had lobbied for a constitutional amendment to make the school levy approval would have been contingent on a majority of voter support rather than the 60% supermajority. We live in the world of the supermajority now. What impact has that had on citizens' ability to see their state stay strong and solvent, do you think?
So, you know, I'm a majority rules person, whether it's in the legislature or whether it's the voters taking control of what's happening in their own district. I just don't think when we turn over the future of whether we're going to pass a levy or whether we're going to pass any sort of revenue issue in the state legislature, turn it over to the minority, it gives a playing field that I don't think is healthy for democracy. So I think the voters should have a majority rules in place for any levies that they pass. And I think we should have majority rules in the legislature when they take action. And the best tool available to a voter when they disagree with something the legislature has done is at the next go round in the voting booth, do what they choose. But to say that we have to turn over to the minority the future of our state, I just think is wrong.
Well, you know, the people who support that say, look, we continue to have a government that grows and that we continue to have employees that are scheduled to get raises in the state, even though some of them have not for a while.
No. Let me I got to clarify this.
What?
Continues to grow. Okay. Currently, We are down to what we were as a state workforce in 1996.
What about our income?
The
That's what they talk about, the income.
Percentage of income is well below what it's been for two decades.
The government. I mean, I don't mean our
the government. Yeah. The government. The government. The state government's share of personal income is well below what it was for at least the last two decades. So make no mistake, the government is not growing. Demand is growing because we're just still in our recession. The expectations are there. And state government, with 1996 workforce levels, is still delivering, still delivering. State employees have not had a raise in at least 4 years. They've had furloughs and pay cuts. Yeah, probably more than that, now that I think of it. They've had furloughs and pay cuts and increased, dramatic increases in their health care costs. And they've had pension reform. So these are people who've stood up and said, we're going to be helpful, we're going to be part of the solution. But they, too, have families that they have to support.
But as you've said, the demands have increased and revenues continue to be the important part of how the government functions and what the critics look at as revenues are always too high. So I'm just trying to figure out, what do you say to those people? What's the argument that you make to them for higher taxes this time, for higher taxes in 2 years?
The bottom line is, if we want to be a state that continues to grow economically, it is dependent on some fundamentals. Do we have the educated workforce for tomorrow? If we don't step up to that challenge, whether it's early learning, K through 12, or higher education, I think all three, you can guarantee we will not be competitive tomorrow. I'm not competing with the likes of Oregon and Idaho today. We're competing on the international scale because we're the most trade-dependent state in the nation. Secondly, you've got to have your basic infrastructure. You've got to have roads and bridges that are safe and secure, that we can get not only people to work and families to where they want to go, but we can get our goods and our services to where they need to be in a timely way. That takes investment. And if we don't step up to those challenges as a state, we will very quickly become a second-rate state. That's not the state I know and love.
Why does that – maybe it's different this year than it was 4 years ago or even 2 years ago. Why does that argument not find more supporters?
Well, you know, I look down in Arizona, highly Republican state. They passed a penny sales tax increase because they couldn't take the cuts anymore. I look at California. They just passed an increase, dramatic increase, in their tax. And that was for education, because they saw their education system deteriorating rapidly. We don't want to get to the edge of the precipice. We as a state are better than that. We need, the Supreme Court said it, but it's not just a legal requirement. It's our moral responsibility to make sure that we are getting these kids the education they need and deserve so they can be productive members of society and be the skilled workforce that will keep the jobs in Washington State and grow the jobs in Washington State.
All right. Lightning round time, since I know I have to let you go at 9:30, but I was looking for something that would rankle you. So back in, I think this was 2007, the 1% property tax cap that was put into law via initiative, then the Supreme Court overturned that, right? They said it was unconstitutional. And then you called a special session and you put that into place. And your critics, on the left, liberals, said you were caving into Tim Iman at that point by accepting that. If you had to do it over again at this late date, would you still put in that 1% property tax cap, or did that limit you?
No, I would do the same thing. And by the way, it took a majority. It took Republicans and Democrats in order to pass that, as we did. And it was agreed before we ever went into the legislative session. It was a one-day session.
That you would have passed it.
That we were going to pass it.
No,
I didn't call it until I had the commitment from the four leaders, Republican and Democrat, that they were going to come in, they were going to pass it, it was going to be a one-day.
But why was that a good idea, given the Supreme Court's own ruling that it was unconstitutional?
What's unconstitutional doesn't mean that it's meeting the needs of the people at large. We've got people with limited income. We've got senior citizens in their homes. We're not going to take away the American dream of everybody having the ability to have their own home and thus pay their taxes. So what we decided that that was the vast majority of the people, and even if the court had said it was unconstitutional, we were going to move forward as the people had expressed, because there were good and solid reasons for the very constituents that Democrats care passionately about. Contrast that, if you will, to this two-thirds requirement in order to pass any revenue in Olympia. I just disagree with that. We are putting Olympia in the hands of the minority rather than saying we're going to do the majority, let the voters decide at the election time who they want to keep in office and who they want to throw out, but we're going to continue to advance the economic prosperity of the state of Washington.
All right. Also, you have just come out recently saying we have to do something about the sales tax exemption for companies that don't collect it. And leaves a competitive disadvantage those companies that do, that are brick-and-mortar companies. This has been a problem for a while. Have you been pushing that the whole time?
I mean, I have.
What keeps it from happening? Is it because Amazon's a big gorilla in this?
No, Amazon's supportive. Amazon is not the problem. We have had those who had signed up to Grover Norquist believing that this was a commitment, so they couldn't do anything about it. Now he has agreed that this is not a new tax and has freed them up so they're not violating their commitment to him. And we have bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. We have been working on this now for a number of years. We are at the point now where we have greater support than I believe we've ever had or possibly ever will have again. And so with that leadership, we want to get it done. It means about $540 million in the next biennium, state and local, about $460 to the state alone. Look at that down payment on education. It grows to $1 billion in the biennium thereafter, and we can't keep hurting our brick and mortar here in the state of Washington. They need to have a level playing field when it comes to the economic opportunities that they need to have in our state.
So we can expect that in your budget.
Well, it's not about in my budget. I have to have Congress pass
it. Yeah, that's right.
I really do.
And they have to step up.
Yep.
You're going to get a report on ocean acidification.
Yes.
What in a half an hour, what kind of expense could be entailed if the state really wanted to see a change in climate, greenhouse gas emissions, which, of course, is, again, you need something for more than just Washington State to have impact. But what kind of costs could be entailed in it?
Well, what I think the report's going to show is that climate change is a real issue, and we can't keep, you know, blinding our eyes and closing our ears to the reality that we're facing. Sandy and what happened back east is an example of it. Now we see with ocean acidification that we're losing our shellfish industry. And we aren't just losing the shellfish industry, by the way. It's a part of the food chain. So we're losing a whole lot more than that. So we're looking at what needs to be done at the national, international level, and we want to be a player and a partner. But we also are looking at what can and should be done locally, because we do not want to lose that shellfish industry. It's like the canary for us, and we want to make sure it's viable, prosperous, and those jobs are good in Washington State.
So you think there's things that the state could do?
Absolutely. Let me give you an example. On Hood Canal, where oxygen depletion is a major reason why we're losing our resources there, we've stepped up to wastewater treatment to get people off septic onto sewer, and it's resulting directly into the opening of shellfish beds that have been closed for decades. So that tells you we're making the Hood Canal healthier for everybody, fishable, swimmable, diggable, which is the policy of Puget Sound Partnership. But we are also making sure that that shellfish industry can grow in Hood Canal where it should. That's what the challenge is for us when it comes to ocean acidification.
All right. Biggest regret of the last 8 years?
You know, I had hoped we would make more progress on the cleanup of Puget Sound. So in the end, it's a bigger challenge, a tougher nut to crack than what we anticipated. And frankly, we got preoccupied with the recession, and it took the attention away from Puget Sound cleanup. We're going to have to refocus, recommit ourselves. I've talked to the governor-elect. He's there, and with his great leadership, I think we're going to get the job done.
And when you when somebody says, Chris Gregoire, she did, what do you want? What do you want them to remember?
Well, I hope they'll remember that we got this state on the right track with early learning, because when kids are ready to learn when they hit kindergarten, they're going to succeed in school and life. That we put the biggest construction investment in transportation in the state's history, and that's investing in our economy. I hope they'll say that I saw us through the worst of times, and I did so with my head and my heart. I took up the challenge, and I met it. And I hope they're proud that we have equality in the state of Washington in marriage. I think that's the only right thing for Washington State, and thank goodness we're a leader in the nation on it.
All right, Governor, I hope we talk again.
Same. Thank you.
Chris Gregoire is the governor of Washington State. This is Weekday.
Coming up next, a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Meacham. His latest book is called Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from TIAA CREF, helping people pursue their financial goals. Learn more at tiaacref.org/WA.
If you're like most people, you rely on a wide variety of sources for the news of the day. I'm John Hockenberry, and on The Takeaway, we draw on our partners, the New York Times, the WGBH Boston Public Radio folks, and experts from around the country, so you can better understand your world. Listen to all the sources each weekday on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
The Takeaway with John Hockenberry, coming to KUOW next week.
Support for KUOW comes from UW School of Public Health, joining Public Health Seattle and King County with a message that there's a miracle drug called physical exercise, and it helps bones, lungs, heart, blood sugar, mood, and mind.
Partly sunny skies and 43 degrees in Seattle. We're expecting a high today of 49. Forecast says it's going to be mostly sunny a little bit later today. Partly cloudy this evening, then mostly cloudy overnight and fairly cold. The low in the upper 30s. We're expecting clouds and showers tomorrow, the high in the upper 40s.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. Who is Thomas Jefferson? He has been portrayed as many different people just over the past few years in different books. John Meacham, who's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize, has written Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. John Meacham received that Pulitzer for his work on Andrew Jackson, American Line. He's also the author of Franklin and Winston, American Gospel, executive editor and executive vice president of Random House, contributing editor to Time Magazine. John Meacham, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
So may I just start by something that sort of wowed me when I read it. This is
sure,
a little bit later. A little bit later in the book. This damned embargo was the chapter. It was Jefferson dealing with what was happening in with England. And you wrote, the presidency was further strengthened and Jefferson's view of power affirmed. And then this is a quote of Jefferson. A strict observance of the written law is doubtless one of the highest duties of a good citizen, but it is not the highest. He wrote that later after he left office. The laws of necessity, of self-preservation, of saving our country when in danger are of higher obligation. That is a remarkable statement for somebody who's supposed to be upholding the law to make.
It's partially the urtext of the imperial presidency. It's something that Lincoln drew on, that FDR drew on, that Reagan drew on, and George W. Bush drew on to some extent. And what the argument there that Jefferson is making is that national survival sometimes requires a kind of extra legal movement, action. In his case, the greatest example I think is not the embargo, because in fact that was a congressional thing. That was the legislature had been consulted, but Louisiana. When Louisiana came up in 1803, they were surprised to find that that Napoleon wanted to sell the land to double the size of the country, and he thought immediately, because Jefferson was at times a strict constructionist, that he wanted to have an amendment to the Constitution to do it, because the Constitution didn't say a president could double the size of the country. Then he got a letter about the third week of August, 1803, saying that Napoleon was rethinking this, and suddenly all constitutional scruples disappeared, and Jefferson went ahead and did what he needed to do. And so there we have the perils and possibilities of politics. One man's an imperial tyrant is another man's shrewd savior.
Well, I started with that, John Meacham, because it seems like it's also sort of at the crux of the question of who this Thomas Jefferson is. Because as you have written in the book and as you talked about in interviews, Thomas Jefferson has been presented in many different ways. The ultimate hypocrite, I think mm-hmm. you said at one point. The ultimate mm-hmm. president, but at another. But so I know this is a whole book about that. But when you just think about the fact that he made this decision, he makes these distinctions between what he believes in for his ideals and what he follows because he is a man with power who wants to wield power. Mm-hmm. How do I end up thinking about him?
Well, you think about him, I think, in terms of each part of his life. You know, it would be lovely if there were such a thing as philosophical consistency in politics, but there's really not. At least successful politicians are not people who can turn in a perfect scorecard at the end of their lives. And Lord knows Thomas Jefferson could not do that. My view is that he introduced, as Abraham Lincoln said, with coolness, forecast, and capacity. I love that. Coolness, forecast, and capacity. An abstract principle into a revolutionary document that's applicable to all men and at all times, that all men are created equal. It's also the man who owned slaves. His life was made possible by slavery. He was tried on a few occasions early in his life to reform the institution of slavery. He lost publicly and decisively. Two things politicians don't like to do is lose publicly and decisively. And so you have to make a judgment there. Does the fact that he articulated the American promise and put in motion the ideas, the thinking, the principles of self-government and human equality that we have been working through, working toward ever since? Or should we condemn him for his slaveholding and his hypocrisy on that? I think you can condemn him, but my view is that, as Arthur Schlesinger once said, self-righteousness in retrospect is easy, also cheap. And I think the moral utility of history, if I may, is not to make ourselves feel better because we're superior to the people in the past, but to judge them by the standards of their day, which includes voices of reform, and also to take away from this study, away from these lives, the sense that they were human beings who lived with phenomenal injustices. Are we human beings who are living with phenomenal injustices? And I would dare say yes. And what will posterity say of us? And I would rather get about the work of moral reform and recovery in real time than I would spending too much time feeling superior to the past.
Well, I don't ask this glibly, but give me an example of where our living with moral injustice is comparable to a dinner Jefferson's having where one of his guests looks up and sees that the slave that is serving him looks exactly like Jefferson, and yet there's nothing ever said about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no moral equivalence between human slavery, but there are enormous issues with moral dimensions. I would argue that climate change is something that is an injustice that we are visiting upon future generations. I would argue that there's still human trafficking around the world. I would argue that hunger in a world as wealthy as this one is inexcusable. I would argue that the growing gap between the rich and the poor in this country and around the world is something that is unjust, and that all of these things require political and cultural attention. And we can provide that political and cultural attention because of the country and the kind of political system that Thomas Jefferson was instrumental in creating.
John Meacham has written Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. May I ask just about, to stick with that scene that you write about later in the book, How were Jefferson? Where people saw that the Hemings looked like Jefferson, other people looked like him. This had been something that was a part of the discussion of the era. How did Jefferson ever respond in some form when people said, "Those look like your kids"?
I don't think anyone ever said that to him. He was a formidable man, and the code of the era would not have allowed that. There are two examples where he responded in some way. One is a denial of the charge that we believe there's some controversy about whether it was referring to the Hemings family. But there is a denial of charges against him that we have. And the other is his daughter once brought a piece of doggerel that involved, I think, the Black Venus, which was the racist phrase of the day that his opponents were using. And he waved it off and didn't say anything, just sort of laughed and waved. So he had no interest in discussing it. And there was a code of secrecy and silence in the South, in the planting states in those years. You know, Sally Hemings herself was the half-sister of Jefferson's wife. Mrs. Jefferson, Patty Jefferson's father, had a child by Sally Hemings' mother, who was a slave of his. So these are endlessly complicated. There's no excusing Jefferson. Let me be very clear. But I think there is a sense of we can't explain him. He could not envision a world without this institution. He knew it was wrong, but there was a tragic, unbridgeable gap between what he knew and what he could do. And my argument is, you know, it took us another 40 years after he died and 600,000 casualties to adjudicate slavery in this country. And then it took a century after Appomattox to pass the most fundamental kind of civil rights and voting rights laws. So before we come down too hard on any one person, I think we should the fault, dear Brutus, is not in the stars but in ourselves.
You write that he did worry about how history would treat the times in which he lived and led. What was he thinking about?
I missed the first part of that.
Well, you write that he did worry about how history would treat the times in which he had lived and led. He said, "We have been too careless of our future reputations." He was talking something specific, of course. "While our Tories will admit nothing to place us in the wrong." But what was he worried about?
He was worried about the ongoing definition and meaning of the American Revolution. It was, as he once put it, a bold and doubtful election between submission and the sword. It was the consuming experience of his life. And he worried that, like a lot of revolutions, if not most, it could be lost. It could be lost in reaction. And in this case, a Federalist reaction, you know, of the Alexander Hamilton, the John Adams, the later George Washington's tendency toward more of a British form of government than what Jefferson thought of as an appropriately American Republican form of government. And so he wanted to leave a historical record that made the argument for democratic republicanism, which is what he embodied. He understood that parties had always existed. He once said, I'm slightly paraphrasing, that men had divided themselves over the opinion of whether the interests of the many or the interests of the nobles should prevail, since those questions convulsed Greece and Rome. So he was always thinking about where the distinctions, where the perennial problems in human affairs came from, partly because he was a man of the Enlightenment. You know, he was of that first generation where suddenly priestly and princely authority were under fundamental assault. The world into which, you know, his fathers had been born was one in which the divine right of kings and the unquestioned rights of the clergy were to be absolute. And what America did is, in many ways, took the Enlightenment thinking about how actually this is a voyage of discovery that human life is precious and is informed from above or from nature in a way that individual rights cannot be taken away by the hand of a king or the hands of a mob. America put that into political expression. They made it real, or at least partially real. And the drama of America, and Jefferson did know this, that the drama of America would be how well it kept that promise that he wrote in that Philadelphia summer in 1776, that all men were created equal.
How do you think he aligned that notion that you describe with his ability to wield power and with his willingness to expand the imperial presidency when it served his purpose?
He would do anything to ensure the survival and success of Republican liberty. That was his principle. You know, that was the thing he wouldn't bend on. Almost anything else was negotiable, which is why Louisiana is so interesting. If Alexander Hamilton had been president and had tried to add Louisiana to the Union without a constitutional amendment, Jefferson's head would have exploded because out of his outrage. But like a lot of people who come to executive power, one is skeptical when one doesn't have that power. When one has it, suddenly they're the enlightened ruler who can make the right decisions. These are fundamental human issues. And what I really want people to come away from this book and then this conversation with is a sense that the Thomas Jefferson I found was a living, breathing human being who lived from 1743 to 1826, who was driven by appetites for wine, women, song, art, architecture, poetry, politics, and power. And whereas we used to see him as a kind of airy philosopher who only thought in big ways, he was a working politician from 1769 to 1809. And watching his political career, watching what he did in politics, is to watch one of the most brilliant Americans who ever lived, by common agreement, do the work of the public good as best he saw it, even though he failed miserably and would be forever imperfect. He did a job that enabled him to create a country, and then that country in better shape than he found it, and by overcoming seemingly insuperable obstacles in real time. And I think that if he can do it with all his failings and all his flaws, then perhaps we can have more confidence that we can do it too.
John Meacham, where was his greatest failure from his point of view?
From his point of view, it might have been slavery. It might have been the emancipation struggles, particularly as he wrote more and more letters about it through the years. He regretted the failure of the embargo against Great Britain in 1807, 1808 to prevent the coming of war in 1812. He had an abiding fear that the British and British forms would put at risk the American Revolution, the thing for which he and so many others had sacrificed so much for. One of the things I argue in this is that the only way, I think, to understand that period of our history is to look at the period of 1763 and the end of the French and Indian War through 1815, the Treaty of Ghent and the end of the War of 1812. As a 50-year war that was sometimes hot and sometimes cold against Britain, and this is an imprecise analogy, but it is, I think, somewhat illuminating. To write about Jefferson, Adams, Hamilton, Washington in that period and not refer to this constant fear of Britain is like writing about Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson and not mentioning the Soviet Union. You know, it was that kind of an enveloping drama. And so he would have accounted himself a great failure if the Federalists of the day, who were more pro-British, had been able to achieve dominance over the Republicans, who were Jeffersonian. And Jefferson won that battle from 1800 to 1840 for 36 of those years. either Thomas Jefferson himself or a self-described Jeffersonian was president of the United States. It's a remarkable political legacy, and it was something that he certainly took pride in with Madison and Monroe, which were the presidents he knew in that period.
Is that also what you would mark as what would you mark as his failure? From having read his books, his writings, all the legacy he left behind, what would you mark as his greatest failure?
His greatest failure is that he did not use the power, the practical power he accumulated, and the gift of expression and clarity and the stage he was given by life and circumstance to do more to end human slavery in the United States of America. He would have been a fairly early actor in that. But, you know, if he had died in 1785, he would be endlessly quoted favorably in terms of abolition. But he didn't. You know, he lived another, 40 years. And the issue there is, here was the greatest politician of the early republic who chose not to pursue slavery as an issue. The greatest politician of the middle of the 19th century, Abraham Lincoln, did. And therein lies the difference between them. Remember, Lincoln was working in a climate that was not rabidly for abolition. The election of 1860, 60% of the country was willing to leave slavery where it was. So, but he used his political skill to change the country on that issue, on that fundamental issue. And Jefferson did not.
John Meacham, author of Jefferson, The Art of Power. We'll hear more from him tomorrow. He'll be at Town Hall tomorrow night at 7:30. Michael Fagan brings us hikes and that go along with the weather. And Michael, how are you?
I'm doing well, Steve. How about you?
I'm doing good. HikeWashington.net, his new website. It'll point us back to his original blog. It'll also tell us what hikes we're supposed to be taking. What do we got for today, and what hike would you recommend?
Well, we actually did Slippery Creek yesterday, and we had our snowshoes all ready with us, and we got to the parking lot, and this hike is incidentally right outside of Enumclaw, between Enumclaw and Crystal Mountain off of Highway 410. We brought our snowshoes, and we looked up at the hills, and there was no snow, so we just left our snowshoes in the car, headed up. This is a logging road, a gated logging road, so there won't be any traffic. And this hike, the mileage was reasonable. It was 4 miles one way, 1,800-foot gain. We got up to 4,000-foot level. There was an inch or two of snow on the ground, so certainly that's not the snowshoe type of conditions. If the views are right, like they'll be today and perhaps tumorrow, you get some nice views of Mount Rainier. So you want to do that today or Wednesday morning, because starting Wednesday afternoon through the weekend, we're going to be getting rain and or snow on and off in the mountains. So, and this is still a good hike, rain or shine. You'll get some exercise. And if you want an alternative, there's Grass Mountain. We went up to this little peak called Slippery Peak, but there's also Grass Mountain. Now, permit, this is you'll need the Hancock permit, and we have the link to that, and it's Green Trail Map 238. So, again, this is a nice one. If you want views, head on out of work right now. You have my permission.
Yeah. Again, we have Michael Fagan's permission before the rains come on Thursday, and snow and rains up in the higher elevations on Thursday or Friday, huh?
That's right. So anyhow, it's that time of the year. So
yeah, it is. Enjoy. All right. Slippery Creek, it's on the hike of the week. You can find it at hikewashington.net. We'll have those links at various places. Michael Fagan comes up with a hike and some weather for us every Tuesday. He works at West Coast Weather LLC, helping folks around the world figure out what the weather conditions will be for their hikes. Michael, good talk to you.
Same here. We'll find another good one next week.
Thanks a lot. And now the sound of the day. That sound comes from our bicycle correspondent, Willie Weir, on a dusty highway north of Mandalay. It was there he came upon a herd of 24 water buffalo. They were bathing in the canal. That's what you heard. The water buffalo were heavy breathers. Splish-splashing is the sound of their ears and horns as they shoo away flies. Water buffalo north of Mandalay. What are you hearing? Oh, a little road traffic. What are you hearing? Send us the sound of the day in the subject line, weekday at KUOW.org. And you can read more about Willie's adventures. Go to yellowtentadventures.com. And you'll see a picture of a water buffalo at our Facebook page, weekday on KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.